thank you everyone for coming, and thank you Ron for having me here, and excited to chat about this. My name is Matt Press. I'm a general internist and health services researcher at Cornell, New York. I was a Robert Wood Johnson clinical scholar in 08 to 2010, so got to know some of the UCLA folks over the years, and I'm glad to be here. So my research is focused on improving care coordination, and I've done most of my work has been on readmissions and care transitions, but I have started to focus more on this issue of communication between clinicians across care settings, and I think this is a huge area going forward, obviously tremendous implications for accountable care, value-based care, and I think it's kind of an underappreciated and definitely understudied aspect of care coordination. So I'm going to talk about a specific study that I recently finished on communication between clinicians in one particular area. First, I'm going to just talk about the urgency of why we need to better understand and improve this aspect of quality of care. I'll go through the quantitative findings of the study. It was sort of mixed methods, and then some of the qualitative findings. I'm going to try to make this a mix of a little research methods-y, a little policy, and a little clinical. And you should feel free to interject at any time with questions. And then at the end, I'll give some editorial comments and next steps. So why should clinicians communicate with each other? It sounds good, but there actually are some real important things that happen when two people communicate. They integrate their expertise. If you think about having, people taking care of a cancer patient or a medical oncologist and a radiation oncologist need to integrate their expertise. They're doing multiple things to a patient. They need to coordinate. This is a big issue, identifying roles and responsibilities. Often there's a lot of confusion and conflict over who's doing what. And then if there are differences in what the best course of care are, they need to be negotiated. So in sum, what happens when two clinicians communicate is they generate a shared mental model of the patient and the priorities for their care. So this has happened in healthcare for a long time, but I would argue that it's changing it's happening. So back in the day, not too long ago, this is, I think, looks familiar to a lot of clinicians in the room. You would sit down in the cafeteria, this is in an inpatient setting, and you would often see the specialists who were taking care of your patients, and you would talk about the patients. This is maybe less familiar to younger clinicians, but this is a dictaphone, and letters between physicians were commonplace. And my feeling, and this is a little bit editorial, is that these modes of communication were more personal. The relationships were more personal between clinicians, between physicians. Now, with everyone's head buried in the EMR and the computer, we have virtual relationships. And so there's certainly ample opportunity for communication to happen through the EMR, but we've lost that personal relationship. And I think that there's kind of an expectation or an assumption now that the EMR, because it's an EMR, will just kind of automatically share information, and you can see my note, then that's good enough. And I would argue that that's not good enough. So now we have lots of things changing in the way healthcare is structured to really emphasize the importance of this issue. So the silos that everyone talks about that plague our healthcare system, now the idea is to put them under one roof, connect them through a shared electronic medical record, even if it's not a physical one roof, like a multidisciplinary or a multi-specialty clinic. It may be a virtual one in the case of an accountable care organization where you have clinicians from different specialties who are not in the same place, but they are mutual. They are have shared accountability for a group of patients. So these issues are particularly relevant for ACOs, medical home and neighborhood, and then health information exchanges, which is trying to connect the EMRs between groups. So there's clearly a healthcare system imperative for better understanding this issue. I think there's most importantly there's a patient imperative.
and I want to show a video clip. So just to re-emphasize the point that I think for a lot of these things to work, a lot of these delivery changes to work, communication between clinicians will need to be a key part of it. I think they could potentially fail, actually, if we don't have good communication between clinicians. So let me show you this clip. Again, this is just to give you the patient perspective. So I'm not presenting cancer-related research today, but I think cancer is an area where these issues are particularly relevant. Complex patients, getting older, more comorbidities, and complex care. And so it's kind of the same issues of communication between clinicians in any area, but I think they're kind of heightened in cancer. This is a video that came out with the recent IOM report on the problems in cancer care right now.
My mom had breast cancer. She was diagnosed when I was 12, and she passed away 2 years later. What I was expecting was when I hit 40, I'd be very vigilant. But breast cancer beat me by 8 years. I was diagnosed at the age of 32. I was going to attack this full on, just fight it with everything possible that was out there. I imagined when I was diagnosed that there would be sort of an integrative system already set in place to help me get the best care. But instead, there was no one there to coordinate my care. I had to do it myself. I was my own caseworker.
A typical person with cancer is being seen by many different physicians and specialists, most who are not communicating with each other. And so the patient, who is physically and emotionally exhausted, is left as the person who is trying to make this coordination happen.
So the breast cancer had spread to my spine and fractured my spine to the point where the spine had collapsed and was threatening my spinal cord. And the only way to correct this was through a spine fusion surgery, this huge surgery that carried a lot of risk. And I wanted the surgeon to speak with my oncologist to kind of know what cancer drugs I was on and how would that react with maybe going into surgery. And what happened is they played eternal phone tag and they never spoke. So it added even more anxiety to the situation I was in going into surgery.
Okay. Those videos, by the way, that came out with the IOM report, which Neil is in this one, actually, I highly recommend them. They did a great job.
Dr. Wenger wasn't the primary care
provider. In that case, I refuse to make it.
Yeah.
Okay, so one area besides cancer care where communication between clinicians is especially critical is during care transitions. And you know, this is getting a tremendous amount of attention on the policy scene nationally, and as a result, hospitals everywhere are frantically trying to improve quality of care during care transitions and reduce readmissions. So the reason communication between clinicians is so kind of interesting here to study and from a quality perspective is there are so many people and so many clinicians involved at the time of hospital discharge. So you've got the whole inpatient team, hospitalist, staff, nurse, social worker, pharmacist, maybe a transitions coach. You've got the whole outpatient cast of characters, primary care, specialists, maybe you have a social worker, you have a home care nurse, home health aide, and all of these people are supposed to work together and ensure a safe transition. So you can imagine if they're not talking to each other, that could be problematic. So the question is, how do we measure the occurrence of communication between any of these parties, assess its quality, and see what its impact is on patient care? So the study I'm going to present now is going to focus specifically on communication between the home health nurse and the primary care physician after discharge. But I think some of the methods and the lessons learned could be applied to communication between any of these groups and in other settings of complex care. So our main aim was to develop a novel method to assess the success of communication between the home health nurse and physician caring for recently hospitalized patients. We also sought to determine the association between communication success and the risk of hospital readmission. We wanted to identify nurse, physician, and patient characteristics that were associated with communication success. And we wanted to explore some barriers, and this is the qualitative piece, to effective communication from the perspectives of nurses and physicians. So I want to show you the conceptual model, not just to, because it's a conceptual model, but because this is specific implications for how we structured the research. So we had theorized that a communication attempt from a nurse to a physician would fall into one of four categories of success. So this is kind of like a timeline. Patient gets discharged from the hospital. The nurse goes to visit them. The nurse attempts to contact the physician. And this is really kind of the key theoretical framework. One of four things could happen when the nurse tries to call the doctor. The nurse could speak with the doctor, which we call an A. The nurse could speak with somebody in the physician's office staff, but not the physician themselves. The nurse could have kind of a one-way communication, like leave a voicemail or send a fax. And the kind of most thing we were most interested in was that the nurse would be unable to reach the physician for a variety of reasons. And the reason we thought this was most important to identify when this happens is because if the nurse can't reach the doctor, then you have no potential for care coordination. Whereas at least here you have some potential. I mean, we don't know if the doctor called back or what the clinical circumstances were, but at least you have some potential. And we felt that if you didn't have any potential for care coordination, it would potentially increase the risk of readmission.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're looking specifically at communication that occurs spontaneously between the nurse and the doc, right? But there is this communication that always occurs, right, when you have to sign their forms.
Right. So that's it. That's in there too, because if the nurse asks the physician to sign the form via mailing a letter, that we wouldn't know, and that happens a fair amount. But if the nurse tries to call the physician to sign off on the plan of care, and then would later send a letter, that we would be looking at that. So it's basically any telephonic attempt to reach the physician is in our purview for this study.
So this is assuming that the letter is going to be meaningless because you've probably seen them before, right?
Right. So from personal experience, they're meaningless, and then there is some research that's been done to show that something like a third of physicians, two-thirds of physicians sign them without even looking at them.
Right, because they've been created for that purpose. So they're actually created not to communicate, right? So you're looking for actual communication.
Exactly. So we were lucky. We partnered with the Visiting Nurse Service of New York, which is the largest nonprofit home health agency in the country. They have a fantastic electronic medical record, and the nurses are mandated to document everything, probably to the detriment of patient care, I think, because I have lots of patients that tell me that when the nurse came to visit them, the nurse was typing the whole time. But in any event, from a research perspective, it's good because there's lots of information in there. And the key, so we got from their record, we identified the patients, we identified the nurse and the physician. The key part of the medical record, which is why we're able to do this study, is that the nurse documents every time they try to reach the physician, and they have a free text field in which they can say what happened when they tried to reach the physician. And I'll show you lots of examples that fit into one of those four buckets. So they spoke to the physician, spoke to the staff, left a message, or weren't able to reach anyone. And I'm going to go through that in more detail. We got Medicare data to identify admissions and readmissions, the AMA master file to identify some physician characteristics. And then for the qualitative piece, again, it was a small qualitative piece. We did two nurse focus groups with 12 nurses in each group, and we did 10 individual physician interviews, half of which were with primary care physicians and half were with specialists, medical specialists or surgeons. We focused on patients who had congestive heart failure, not necessarily admitted for congestive heart failure, but who had congestive heart failure for a couple reasons. One, it's a chronic condition. Two, a high risk of readmission. And three, we sort of hypothesized that this is a condition that could be amenable to a successful communication, actually keeping the patient out of the hospital. Because you can imagine patients putting on weight or getting more short of breath, the nurse can call the physician, the physician might say, try a little more Lasix. But if the nurse can't reach the physician and the patient's more short of breath, they might have no choice but to send them to the ER. And these patients were treated in 2008 or 2009, again, all of whom had a hospitalization, all of whom got home care after they were discharged, and all of whom had one communication attempt between the hospital discharge date and 30 days after readmission. So with exclusions, we ended up looking at 6,700 unique individuals, each of whom had one hospitalization and episode of home care in the study sample. Our outcomes were basically Medicare's, or in the case of CHSF specific readmission, this is CMS's metric, and then the all condition, which is any index hospitalization that's probably assumed to be CMS metric. But we calculated it in the same way CMS does. And so it turns out, you know, assessing the quality of communication is challenging, and there are lots of different ways to look at it. So this is our key independent variable, is how successful was the nurse at reaching the patient's physician. And the main way we looked at it was to come up with a communication failure rate. So for every patient with a hospital discharge and an episode of home care, there were a certain number of attempts from the nurse to the physician, and I'll show you how many there were on average, but you know, everyone had a handful, let's say. And we looked at how many of those attempts were decommunications, meaning the nurse was unable to reach the physician. And we said, okay, for that patient, you had, let's say, 4 attempts in 30 days. The nurse failed to reach the physician one of those times. That's a 25% failure rate. So, you know, there were pros and cons of doing it that way. And so we looked at doing it some other ways to say, okay, what was the success rate? How often did the nurse actually speak to the physician in the numerator, and then the total number of attempts in the denominator? And then two other ways to look at failure: was there any failure, just a binary variable, and was the first attempt, which arguably is maybe the most important to establish a plan of care or the nurse's first assessment of the patient, did that one fail or not? So for looking at the impact of communication success on readmission, we did a logistic regression estimating the effect of communication failure or success on risk of readmission. We did a sensitivity analysis using a Cox proportional hazard model where each communication attempt, whether it failed, whether it was a failure or a success, what its impact on the subsequent risk of readmission was until the next communication attempt. And then to look at nurse and physician characteristics that were predictive of communication failure success, we did another logistic regression model. In all the models, we did had lots of covariates from the visiting nurse. Electronic medical record has not only demographics, comorbidities, but lots of information about do they have informal support at home, how long they were in home care, how many home care visits they had. We did not have information about the patient's visit to their physician. For the main model looking at the impact on readmission, we used nurse fix effects, but then to look at specific nurse characteristics, we had information on how they were paid, whether they were paid per diem or on salary, what their degree was, less than a bachelor's or more, and their number of years of experience. For physicians, we had specialty whether or not they were board certified and how many years of experience they had. And again, we used hospital fixed effects in the main regression model. So the main effort in this study was developing a basically a natural language processing method to assess whether or not communication was successful. Because in our original study sample, we had there are over 50,000 communication attempts. It's obviously unreasonable to go through each of those by hand. So we spent a lot of time and felt very good about some of the validation, which I'll show you in a second, about our ability to develop this natural language processing algorithm to read the free text in the nurse's attempt to reach the physician to determine whether or not that indicated one of those four categories of success, A, B, C, or D. So in order to do this, and by the way, I had never done natural language processing before we started doing it, and it was quite a good experience. So the first step was to identify keywords that would go with each of those four categories, A, B, C, or D. So you can imagine you start with spoke with physician, that's an A, or couldn't reach physician, that would be a D. But it turns out with free text that the nurse could enter 1,000 different permutations of the word of that phrase, spoke with MD, could say spoke with physician, spoke with MD, spoke with DR, talked to DR, you know, literally thousands of different permutations. So we would a priori come up with what we thought were keywords that went into each of those four categories, group them into concepts. So DR, MD, physician, all was a physician concept. Spoke with, discuss, talk to, all was a concept of talk to. And then the algorithm would go through those free texts and try to pick up the concepts, try to put each free text, which would have a different, you know, whatever the nurse wrote, the algorithm that would recognize those keywords and put them into one of the concepts that we identified, and then match the concept into one of the four different categories of success. And it did it hierarchically. So if it said, spoke with MD about, you know, message I left, so that's two different concepts. That's a spoke with MD concept and a message left concept. It would give preference to the A, the success. And I would say, in general, we were pretty generous towards giving the nurses the benefit of the doubt for a successful communication. And then we would review random samples of the matched ones to determine to look to see if the way we were coding it made sense. And then ones that didn't get coded, we would go back and look for more keywords to figure out why they weren't getting coded. We went through this cycle 17 times over the course of probably 6 months. And ultimately, the algorithm coded 55,000, which is under 55,000 attempts, and the algorithm worked on like 54,000 of them. So there were only 1,500 that we had to hard code, that the algorithm couldn't assign into one of those four buckets. We had to do it by hand, and we did that with two separate investigators and a third who was a tiebreaker. We did an external validity test of this algorithm to see if it was doing what we wanted it to do, if it was putting the communication attempts into the buckets that we had set up a priori, that A through D buckets. So we gave three home health nurses who had not been involved in the study at all 100 communication attempts. We gave them just kind of a conceptual explanation of the four buckets and said, put these in each of these attempts into one of the buckets. And it turns out that the way those independent nurses assigned the buckets was almost identical to the way the algorithm did so. So we felt comfortable that the algorithm was doing what we wanted it to do, at least in terms of determining whether the communication attempt was a D versus not a D, because we were most interested in these failures to communicate. So I'll give you just a couple examples pulled from the actual analysis of what each of these communication categories looked like. So an A, which was, again, a nurse-physician communication, it could be direct, like the nurse said they spoke with the physician, or indirect, so if it said, as you'll see in this example, patient has a low pulse today, 48 to 52, this is the nurse writing this free text. This is what we, this and 55,000 other ones are what we analyzed. Nurse called the MD office and spoke with so-and-so. As per so-and-so, MD stated that was okay and made no changes. So that was an A because the physician was involved in the communication. A B, which is spoke with just the staff, said, MD busy, left message with secretary, RE, wound care nurse's recommendation for wound care. So that would, the algorithm would actually pick MD busy up as a D, okay, but then left message with secretary would get a B, so the hierarchy assigns that particular communication attempt to B.
Is that a C? Because it's one-way communication, right?
We felt that if you spoke to a person, you had, we could give that a little bit of a bump up because you might feel more confident that the message would actually get to the physician, whereas a C is you don't know what happened. You just left them at a voicemail or sent a fax.
You obviously don't work in our clinic.
I was thinking the exact same thing.
So an example of C is here, message left for MD, RE changes in plan of care. And then here's an example of a D, no MD claims to no patient. And you can imagine this is becoming more of an issue with hospitalists who are setting up home care at the time of discharge. And that's the name that the home health nurse has. And then the home health nurse sees the patient and calls the hospitalist. And the hospitalist says, I took care of the patient in the hospital. Find somebody else to call. So for our 6,700 patients, this is how their communication attempts broke down. So 47% were, the algorithm assigned to the A bucket, 23% in the B, 20% in the C, and 6% were failures to communicate. And so on one hand, 6%, when you look at the whole batch of 15,000 is not that much. Although on the other hand, that's 1,000 times that the nurse tried to reach the physician and was unsuccessful, and we felt very confident that they were unsuccessful in reaching the physician. So, that's a lot of man hours wasted. We'll see if it had any impact on quality of care or outcomes of care, I should say. And it's I like to think often about, what's acceptable in other industries, and would that be an acceptable failure rate in any other industry?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
I just want to understand, because it's been a long time since I've set up home health care for someone. Does a nurse call routinely when they see the patient the first time, or only if there are problems or things that need to be clarified?
They have to have the physician sign off on the plan of care.
Regardless,
but they could do that via a letter, so they do not have to call.
Okay. So maybe the failures are, there was something more serious going on, potentially. Prompting them to call.
So everyone in this study had at least one phone attempt. Mm-hmm. So if you had no phone attempts, you're not in the study.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out why a nurse would, if it's easier just to send a letter.
Yeah.
Or, from the nurse's perspective, what makes them want to call? Is it that they need reassurance about something, they're feeling
right,
uncomfortable?
It could be anything. It could be something acute came up. It could be they need to clarify something. It could be they want to, some nurses want to confirm verbally the plan of care. Or the doctor never sends in the letter,
okay,
which I think happens a lot.
And do you have any information on how long it took them to reach them, right? Because if you fail 60% of the time, but you call back 20 minutes later and you're...
No.
Or at least repeat attempts within some reasonable...
No. So we have the timestamp on the communication attempt, but for this analysis, we didn't look at it. So if you got a D and then called back 20 minutes later and got an A, or the physician called you back and the nurse documented that, those would go into the model as an A and a D.
The actual reason for initiating the communication was not captured in the model.
Correct.
So the patient could be quite ill.
Correct.
But but have good communication.
Exactly.
Just clarify, so you had 50-something thousand messages. You have 15,000 here.
Yeah.
What?
We excluded lots of patients who didn't have a previous hospitalization. That was most of the patients. So it was the total sample size was like 15,000 patients. When we said you have to have a previous hospitalization, you have to have CHF, you have to have at least one communication end, we got down to 6,700 patients. For those 6,700 patients, there were 15,000 attempts. So there are lots of attempts that are not in the study that, you know, I want to do another study where we compare post-acute home care to community, because lots of referrals now to home care, which is, I think, a relatively new phenomenon that patients get home care without ever having been hospitalized. Mm-hmm. And so to see, you know, if there are any differences in communication in those two groups. But this is just post-acute patients.
But are these all separate? So it isn't like one of the Bs turned into an A later when they're not...
No, it's all separate. They're all separate, yeah.
What is indirect?
I'm sorry?
What is indirect? RNM.
Indirect is like this one. Nurse called and spoke with, this is a staff person, and the staff person said, according to the MD, this is okay. So the MDs, so it's not a direct communication, but the MDs involved in the communication. We said that, we gave them the benefit of the doubt and said that's an A.
I'm not sure I understand. Yeah. Your response to Neil's question.
Yeah.
I thought you said earlier that you could have a D and an A.
For the same person, yeah. Correct. Oh, I thought, yeah, Neil, so you were asking if the individual attempt could, do we change the attempt? So if one person had two attempts and the first one failed and then the next one was a success, that person had two attempts, their failure rate would be 50%. One out of two of the attempts failed.
From what you said so far, I'm not sure. It seemed like the key would be if you were failed all the way through, right? That if you had any success, that might be all that really matters, and it's not clear that you're really going to see that.
Right, so that's why, you know, we looked at it, the failure, a couple different ways. Did you have any failure? We looked at it as a continuous variable, as the rate, because so you're alluding to 100% failure rate.
Yeah.
So we would see that. If there was some relationship between higher failure rate and readmission, we would see that. But there are also issues with the rate, because in the denominator, the rate is the number of attempts, and the longer you're in home care, the more opportunity you have for communication attempts, and the longer you're in home care means you were less likely to get readmitted because you were in home care. So there's problems with the rate. That's why we looked at it in a couple of different ways. So when we looked more closely at the D attempts, the failures, and looked at why they failed. And this is not super specific, but I think gives you some idea. So let's focus on this side here. So this is the reason for they got a D, and this goes along with the concept that the algorithm identified. So this light green here was that 19% of the time the office was closed. So, you know, kind of an after-hours access issue. And, you know, lots of people are doing interesting research now on after-hours access to their physicians. So it includes nurses, too, not just patients. 17% of the time that we assigned it a D, it was because there was no answer, the line was busy, or they were unable to leave a voicemail. And then, you know, the last 10% here, MD was away or on vacation, wrong number, or the wrong physician. So at least 46% were a specific problem with access to the MD. These other two parts of the pie were non-specific, unable to reach MD or MD unavailable, but those could also, had the nurse written a more detailed note, could have fit into one of these issues. So it seems like access to the MD, and I'll show you some of the qualitative data that confirms this, that access to the MD is an issue.
You know, one thing that's really interesting to me looking at that is that the majority of the etiologies are things that one would say are preventable.
I would agree.
Without much resources.
I would agree. And I'll show you in the qualitative stuff. So on average, the number of communication attempts were actually quite small per patient. So this is just, you know, kind of baseline characteristics of the 6,700 patients. They were old, they had what you would expect for remission rate. Number of communication attempts, I thought, again, on average was pretty small, only about two, but the range from 1 to 25. We had 300 some hospitals, 1,000 nurses, 3,000 physicians. The average failure rate, and this should not be surprising to you because there weren't a ton of failures, but the average failure rate, so this is on average per patient, was 8%. So meaning on average per patient, like 1 in 10 communication attempts failed. For the A rate, on average, just under half were successful. In the unadjusted analysis, readmission was significantly correlated with failures, and it didn't matter how you looked at failures. So one way to look at it would be the failure rate, and if you categorize it, low failure rate, moderate failure rate, high failure rate. The high failure rate group had the highest readmission rate. If they had one failed attempt versus none, they had higher readmission rate. If the first attempt failed versus the first attempt being successful, they had higher readmission rate. Unadjusted. When you adjust for everything, nurse fixed effects, hospital fixed effects, all the patient characteristics, the significance of the relationship between any of the ways we looked at success or failure communication and readmission went away. So these are all non-significant coefficients. For failure rate, any attempt failed, first attempt failed, and success rate was all not significant. And then when you look at what nurse, physician, and patient characteristics predicted success or failure, found a couple, I just plucked out a couple of the significant ones here. So patient, this is patient zip code census, median income for the zip code, patient zip code of residence. Patients who were in higher income zip codes relative to less than 30,000 is the reference group here, had lower failure rates. So wealthier patients had lower failure rates, and one significant finding for a higher success rate. Nurses who had more than a bachelor's degree had lower failure rates than nurses who had less than a bachelor's degree. And surgeons, relative to primary care physicians, had lower success rates. All right, so I'm going to get into the qualitative findings now. Any questions on the quantitative findings? Okay. So overall, the nurses had a lot more complaints than the physicians about communication. But the physicians still had complaints, and so we put both parties' complaints into three categories: accountability, accessibility, and approach. So accountability is the issue of, is there a physician who's willing to be responsible for overseeing the patient's home care? And I alluded to this a little bit with the hospitalist issue. So one nurse said, when the patient comes out of the hospital and they don't have a community doctor, we try to get in touch with the referring physician, but the doctor will just say, no, I'm not going to talk about that patient. He's not my patient. I just saw him in the hospital. Primary care physician said, that we interviewed, said, if I didn't see the patient, I don't feel comfortable. I advise the nurse to reach the other physician. And then the specialist said, I'd say the nurses contact me rarely for issues I shouldn't be dealing with, i.e. vital signs. Although I'm not sure why the specialist feels they shouldn't be dealing with vital signs. It does happen once in a while. I assume they are calling the PCP, and that's who's dealing with these things. So, it's like that cartoon I showed earlier about the hot potato. No one wants to catch it. In terms of access, we talked about this earlier on the concepts behind the different D attempts, a lot of them being access related. So access refers to, can the home health nurse reach the responsible physician in a timely manner, including after hours and on weekends, and can the MD reach the nurse? So one of the nurses said, you leave a message, you can't get the doctor. By the time you turn around, the patient is back in the hospital. Specialist said, typically the nurses call my office line. My secretary or office has to find me, and that's incredibly inefficient. I don't routinely give out my cell phone number, so they don't have it to call me. You would think maybe that person would think about giving out their cell phone or coming up with some other way to get around it, but access is an issue for them. Primary care physician said, a lot of nurses know me, I know them, they have my phone number, I have their phone number, I'd rather you call me first than reflexively send someone to the ER with something we can deal with. And then the last category of barrier to effective communication is the attitude, knowledge, and skills to collaborate and manage a patient at home. And I think, you know, this is a big issue in collaboration between any clinician, primary care specialist, nurse, physician. Are we equipping our healthcare workforce with the skills and tools and willingness to actually work together? So one nurse said, I've gotten hung up on, yelled at by the doctor for me giving her suggestions that the patient should go to a cardiologist. She's just like, who are you? You're just a nurse. A primary care physician said, I believe home care does help me take care of the patient. I appreciate it because it's the second eye that sees the patient. So not everyone had bad things to say. And a specialist said, I have no faith that who I'm talking to has an appropriate understanding of what is going on. Basically, it is a pre-911 call. Okay, so in summary in the study, a couple things. So just going back to the original conceptual model I showed you. Determining whether communication attempt was successful or failed is possible to do with computerized analysis of free text or natural language processing. And so I think this is a promising area to further investigate communication between the clinicians in a variety of settings. 14% of cases had at least one attempt fail, 8% had half or more fail. So again, I think maybe a little bit less than we had thought a priori, but still probably an unacceptable amount of times it's happening. And then the nurses and physicians identified in the qualitative work remediable barriers to communication. I agree with the comment made that these things are fixable. In terms of the direct effect of communication failure on readmission, it was mostly explained by other variables. So, like I said, I've done a lot of readmission research and published some stuff criticizing readmissions as a quality metric, as have lots of other people. And so I'm not dismayed by the fact that we didn't find a significant risk-adjusted relationship between communication failure and readmission. I maybe it's my own bias, but I don't think that means that the failure, communication failure, is necessarily a bad measure or that we did a bad job measuring it. I think that lots of things, as everyone knows, go into readmission, and lots of studies have had null findings with an impact on readmission. I think we could have looked at other outcomes. Lots of things. If you want a care transition specific outcome, you could look at something like Eric Coleman's care transition measure to see from the patient's perspective how they feel the quality of their care transition was. You could look at other adverse outcomes, medication errors, duplicate testing, lack of completion of outstanding tests from the hospital, no follow-up of abnormal tests. Lots of bad things happen after discharge. Readmission, again, is complex, and maybe that's why we didn't see an effect. All right, so I just want to finish with some editorial comments. I've already made a lot of editorial comments, but just a few more. And then some next steps research-wise, and would love to get people's comments and feedback. So a couple of years ago, Atul Gawande, in a commencement speech at Harvard, had this line that got a lot of attention. He said, we train, hire, and pay doctors to be cowboys, but it's pit crews people need. And I think this resonated with people that, in this era of healthcare, we need to think more about collaboration, teamwork, et cetera. I would argue that in the future, models of healthcare where care is being delivered in different settings, and again, where clinicians are being held accountable, clinicians in different settings are being held accountable for patients that they share, rather than being pit crews, we need to be air traffic controllers. And I don't think that means just hiring nurse care managers to do the care coordination work. I think, lots of places are doing that. And I'd be curious to, I think every place is doing that basically. I think there are a couple problems with that. Number one, I think a lot of communication needs to be physician to physician, and I think we run the risk of everyone's hiring nurse care managers, and the care coordination communication tasks are put off on the nurse care manager. We could further fragment the system, because then you have a nurse care manager needs to talk to the nurse care manager who needs to talk to the physician, and we're kind of further dividing physicians in different settings from each other. So I think, you know, I think we need to just continue to assess that strategy. So I think we could do a few things in the research. I think we need new measures of communication across settings. So in terms of measurement, I think natural language processing has promise. I'm doing some work with social network analysis, where you look at relationships between physicians who share patients using claims data, and other groups are doing that too. You know, you can think about structured fields in the EMR. Are there ways to, Josh and I were chatting about, you know, the messaging that occurs within the EMR. Are there ways to assess communication in that? So that's the research aspect. I think a huge piece of this is education. I alluded to this before, that you know, are we equipping our workforce with the right tools and skills to communicate with each other? Specifically interested physicians, but obviously applies to others. And then in practice, and the you know, on the operations side, I think we've got a couple solutions that you know, I don't think we need randomized trials necessarily to test them out, but you know, you can imagine some low tech support tools like a communication checklist that's part of an EMR. You can imagine some higher tech ones like a wiki page within the EMR that allows physicians to you know, have a single document rather than just adding you know, another layer on the EMR, but a single document where physicians can update and edit from their perspective what's going on with the patient. You have kind of like a synthesis, because we're really lacking a synthesis. There are other high-tech things like e-consult programs, you know, lots of places are doing, but I was just at Geisinger a few weeks ago. They have an e-consult program that enables real-time consultation with any specialist, primary care specialist, and includes a video consultation so that the specialist can see, if you're a primary care physician, the patient's in the room with you, and you want kind of, you know, what we used to call a curbside, you could do that via video conference, and they actually compensate both PCP and the specialist for the time that they spend doing a virtual consult.
Well, how about a really stupid idea, like getting the thing that we all always sign to be intelligible?
Agree.
I mean, why?
Well, so the crazy thing is that the Visiting Nurse Service of New York has an electronic portal for physicians to view. Now, maybe the document is just as bad as it is in paper, but they have an electronic portal and no one uses it, just like all the other the health information exchanges and portals, because it takes this extra step of signing in and logging on and blah, blah, blah. So I agree, we can make the document better, and we can make the, you know, in the home health setting, make the document better and make the way the document is shared better.
So let me take a contrary position.
Please.
The discussion.
Yeah.
I don't think that primary care doctors should spend one more minute communicating with anybody. They're underpaid for what they do. We have a health system that, you know, I mean, the way we pay doctors.
Yeah.
They're not being paid to communicate.
Absolutely.
You know, they're now being given all kinds of mandates.
Yep.
Record system.
Yep.
I spent 20 minutes yesterday online because a patient called to complain about the way in which the diagnosis, which was coded for her visit, mm-hmm. which had no impact on anything except she was unhappy about it, right. So I had to go in and figure out how do you change this thing,
yep.
And I got it changed. I could have done a cataract procedure.
Right,
right.
Yeah.
And the point is that the specialists, you know, who, now they're, there are many wonderful doctors there,
yep.
But there are a lot of people who are there who are busy running the till.
Yeah.
And that's what they do.
Yep.
And they don't see themselves as having any responsibility for this.
Of course.
And it all, you know, we know what flows downhill, and it all comes down to the primary care doctor.
Right.
And so I think things that are going to improve all of this kind of thing
yeah.
are just going to afflict primary care doctors.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is all in the context of the need for payment reform, these editorial comments are not at all just for primary care physicians, if anything. I mean, there are plenty of primary care physicians, by the way, who are on the till, who are churning through patients and could give, you know, two cents about communicating with specialists. I hear you, and, you know, this needs to be part of overall transformation of care that we all, you know about, Robert.
Do you think the model of the visiting nurse service is ever going to work? Compared to embedding them within a health system, within an ACO, where there's shared incentives for actually achieving communication?
Yeah, well, I mean, an ACO certainly makes sense to me as the fix to this, where the home health nurses, where the incentives are aligned. That said, even if all the incentives are aligned and you've got a shared record, you've got all the structure to support collaboration, that doesn't guarantee that's going to happen. So if people are still on the treadmill, it's not going to happen. And it doesn't mean it's going to happen well. So that's why I still think, even if you've got the, like, you know, Cadillac ACO, you still need the skills, you still need the support tools, you still need the payment to align at the individual clinician level.
So if you had all the money in the world to develop an ideal system, you kind of preempted my question by saying you think that physicians should be more involved in the different kinds of communication. It seems like there's plenty of room, right, to clarify that. There's huge variation between the physicians who think it's totally worthless, those that say I do it all the time, the nurses, as you're saying, like they either refer, you know, they call up every single time. I'm sure there's some on there that never call ever because they just don't feel. Whenever you see variation like that, usually it means that we have no idea what the hell is worth doing.
Yeah.
And so, from your perspective, like, you know, what actually is important? I mean, almost certainly the answer is it depends, right, on what the content of that message is. Right. And I think everybody would get, you know, much more on board with the whole enterprise if physicians, you know, could say, ah, yeah, I see why that matters.
Right.
And the nurse knew, they're like, ah, for this crap, you know, I can go to somebody else.
Yeah.
The air traffic controller, it's important they talk to the pilot about how fast you're coming in, where the hell are you, and who else is flying around you, but like how much Diet Coke there is left is probably you know, not necessary for them to know.
I agree.
It seems like, I don't know if you've thought about, you know, trying to actually look at the content of that to figure out, you know, before you even get into the better system, because otherwise you're just going to end up opening.
I think there's a perverse incentive from talking to these nurses to document. And for some of them to call, it's kind of like a, you know, cover yourself to call. And so there needs to be education on what's appropriate to call. Are there other ways to handle things? I'm not saying that all communication needs to be physician to physician. There's certainly, and we don't know what, you know, necessarily where to draw that line. But I think the strategy of some health systems to, and this is outside the home health issue, but to just hire more nurses to do this stuff is, we're going to perpetuate the problem, actually, the problem that you're talking about.
So I'm probably going to harp on the same issue, but a little differently. 75% of the cases, there wasn't a readmission. And you started by saying, if the patient were gaining weight, there's clearly a need to increase LASIK. So I want to come back to that, because I think that's the critical point. One doesn't know, most of the air controllers don't talk to the pilots if they're going along and there isn't some reason to change. So they don't keep calling in and say, hi, I'm doing fine.
Right.
I've got another 5 miles.
Right.
It's 100 miles, right? They only call when there has to be a change or when there's a critical point.
Right.
So using your data, did you or are you going to go back and look at, is there something the nurse had, such as weight increasing, increasing shortness of breath, PND, whatever it is, where that's a critical factor, and then what was the success rate?
Right.
Because just getting all this, you know, 4 pages that I sign, usually 3-4 weeks later when I finally see it, is meaningless. So the critical elements, just like our nurses only call us on the wards when there's something that needs to be done. They don't call us all the time saying, Marty's doing fine.
Right.
It's a great point. It would be extremely challenging for us to do it with the data set. One issue is that when the nurse calls a physician, it may not necessarily be tied to a specific visit or a specific, you know, specific physical symptom or something. So the nurse could have seen the patient a few days earlier and be calling now because the patient called them. So drawing the line from nurse sees patient and recognizes XYZ symptoms to nurse calls physician is not the simplest thing. It will be the case in some circumstances.
But you might look at You might look at just the low-hanging fruit.
Absolutely.
Which is, they say that, you find that as, since you did the whole thing on, you know, come up with something that can analyze patient words, something, it'd be very interesting to kind of just look at that. I think subsets, if you have all this data.
I agree.
I take it you haven't looked at ER visits or ER visits without hospitalization?
No, we didn't. Because it's not, we bought the Medicare inpatient data set, MedPAR, so the ER visits are not in there. But you're right, this is a huge, in terms of adverse events after discharge, ER without readmission is a big one.
Can you look in the visiting nurse's treatment plan? There are treatment changes after a call, so you would be kind of differentiate between a routine and something that, you know, changed the patient's course, or is it hard to do that?
It would be hard to do. They we thought about it. It would be hard to do, but it's a great suggestion. All right, well, thank you guys very much for having me.